let's start the record. So today we're going to talk about one way of making modules out of your code, in the sense of ways to connect call sites to definition sites of methods. That's what dispatching, no, not like this. That's what dispatching method calls is all about. This may seem simple at first, but believe me, there's a lot of things to think of when you come to method dispatching. So what we're going to do today is we will start with a little bit of motivation and kind of the state of the art, what is done in major object-oriented languages like Java or C# or even C++. That's what we're doing in the first part, and you'll see there's already a lot of things you have to be aware of when you use this method dispatching. Then there's there's challenges that cannot be solved so that you're really content with your solution in current single dispatching systems. So that's what we're going to see here. And then there's the propositions, one principles that's not so much done right now in the mainstream languages. That's multi-dispatching. We will see a formal model for that and have delve into the details how it is solved in certain languages. Okay, so that's what we're going to do today. Let's start. What is the typical problem with dispatching? Let's have a look at a very common problem that may arise in a similar form, probably not as simple as we have here, but in a similar form in your code, especially when you do object-oriented programming. In many cases, you have situations where you have kind of a base object, like this object here, that offers basic functionality like equals. It's defined over there, and then you come and specialize the object. You derive your own class from that, and you have the desire to provide your own version of the code here, and then you let the system interact with some infrastructure things like sets and collections and all that. And what you might come up with in this situation is something like this. So I've started with a new class that's here for implementing something like natural numbers. I know this is something that is in a language like Java already implemented in something like integer, but as this is read-only, I've done it once again here too. And yeah, it's a very simple one that's has a little bit of enhanced functionality compared to the normal integer, in the sense that it always keeps the absolute of the value that you use for constructing this. Okay, so there's a little bit of a speciality in there. And the main thing that I want to draw your attention to is that I want to manage these things in some kind of set. The typical way to do, to use them is, well, you generate your natural objects, and if you create another one that is meant to be the similar meant to be evaluated to the same value, you would like to have them be identical. And in order to do that, you normally implement something like this equals method. And in this case, we can quite easily decide whether we want them to be equal, or whether we consider them to be equal or not, by comparing the number attribute that we have. And yeah, the desired outcome for the whole thing would be that we have only one natural number, that's the zero in there. But yeah, you see, if you implement the whole thing like this, you will end up with having two zeros in there. Of course, provided that there's a print version for the whole thing, that represents them as the numerical value. So any ideas why that might be? Yes. Exactly. So with when you provided the object with your equals method that takes naturals, you might end up testing the whole thing with two naturals, and you might get that doing equals on two naturals will, of course, do the right thing and tell you that they are equal. But the problem is that, you intended to overwrite the equals that is already provided in your object, and that is the equals that is used inside this set implementation. And turns out that if you give the whole system something like this equals on natural, this won't connect to the one that you have further up in your hierarchy. So what's it all about? So for the sake of explanations, and we should first, I should probably first tell you that I have a few fractions there that are meant to be language independent. In a language like Java, you have this very prominent thing of having expressions on the left-hand side, and then have a dot, and then the name of a method. That is a kind of very special notation that treats your first parameter to a method in a kind of privileged way. This first parameter is often called the receiver of a method, and in languages like Java or C++, they are treated with special means. They are moved outside of the parameter parentheses and put to the front of the method call. This is because the designers of the language thought it would be a good idea to stress this very first parameter to make sure that you remember that there's polymorphic things going on there, and these polymorphic things are dependent on this very first parameter. But yeah, in general, you can consider methods like these. And especially the expression in the front as being kind of the first parameter to this method. So, yeah, that's why I have a few parts in this lecture where the first parameter is moved back into the parameters list. So, yeah, that's just to confuse you a little bit. Okay, so for the explanation how this method dispatching actually works is, yeah, I have here the model how the whole thing works. This is for all the methods that are dynamically dispatched in Java, that is all the ones that are not specifically marked as being statical. In C++, you have, for example, this virtual keyword with which you mark methods as being resolved dynamically. So, in principle, you have several components that work together for this mechanism. At first, there's a thing that, it's this one over here, that is in the, from the point of view of dynamical dispatching, these are called generic functions. I know in something like Java this is overloaded with some other meaning, but when you concentrate on this this aspect of dispatching, there's generic functions. These generic functions kind of start a whole family of method signatures that are considered to connect to each other. That is something that we have seen that has failed in the very first example. There's this generic function that was introduced in the object class that was called equals and had a very specific signature. And this was meant to spawn a new family of of method signatures that were together and connected to work with virtual dispatching or dynamical dispatching. And with the one that we provided, we failed to connect to this family. How can you connect to a family that is spawned with such a generic function? Well, the important thing is the signature of this method. The signature of the method is, of course, at first, for once, the actual name that matters. Then there's the types of the parameters and also the type of the return value. Those things contribute to the signature of such a method. And the thing is, you can add concrete methods to this family that are associated with the generic function or belong to this generic function. And whenever a call to with the signature of the generic function actually appears in your code, this is dispatched to the appropriate concrete method. How do they connect? How do I determine whether they the concrete method belongs to the generic method? The concrete method is allowed to provide a specializer in the sense that it might specialize on certain things. These things are the types that are used for the return value and the first parameter. Keep in mind that this first parameter is this special receiver parameter. That is the thing that in mainstream languages is put in front of your method call. So what you can specialize in mainstream languages is actually this parameter, and this is your standard polymorphic calls that you know. You are allowed to specialize a method by introducing a method in the body of the child that has a signature where the return type of the method might be more special than your ancestors, and you also are allowed to specify a more specific receiver type. And by putting the method into the body of the child, you have already done that, because this is then associated with the type of the child, which is already more special than your ancestors. So for the rest of the parameters that come after this the first one, you are not allowed to do anything more special. So the things that we've seen in the example before, where we have used a more special version of the type for the first parameter, actually do not work anymore. So are there any questions to this concept? No? Fine. Nice. So let's have a few examples. So the things that we've using here is that's just once again illustrating how this dispatching works or works not. That is once again illustrating what is happening inside the hash set. So that's something that we have already coded. What happens? The problem is that inside the hash sets, there is the call is actually happening with the static signature or compile time signature of equals, with the first parameter being of type object and the second parameter also of type object. So the only things that are considered as being of the same family of these things would be the ones that are specialized on the first part. But you see, the only concrete method that we provided was one that was specialized on the first and the second parameter, like this. And yeah, these do not connect. They are not in the same family. This concrete method does not belong to the generic one that we have specified in the object. So the only implementation that is found is the one that we have from object, and this is implemented somehow different, probably comparing the object identities to each other, and they're all always considered different for different objects. Okay, so in something like Java, you are only allowed to specialize the return type and the first argument, which is done implicitly by putting the whole thing in the child class. So yeah, that's what happens in Java, and yeah, you end up with your code not working. Yeah, the other thing is something that I've told you already with static methods. Yeah, you'll see that yeah, there's no dynamical dispatch happening at all. Okay, so that's how this dynamic dispatch works. This looks quite easy at the beginning, but turns out that this is a little bit challenging also. So I've put up a little quiz for you. There's not so much happening here. There's only two classes involved. There's a class A and a class B, and they offer a few methods, M1 to M3, and one convenience method, P, which is only used to print text, so that I'm able to see which of the methods are actually called. So, yeah, what might happen in this first example? Don't worry, it's no exam yet. You can still do errors. Errors are especially something that I actually enjoy, because they make me explain you what's happening there. So don't be afraid. Java is one thing that is learned in the very first semester. You should be able to do that. Ah, nice. There.
I think it's M1A in A.
M1A in A. Well. So, what was happening here? Can you tell me why?
When we make the call M1, A point M1 B, what we do is we consider the static type of the argument. So we know that the static type of A is A, and the static type of B is also B. So we look in A for a method that would match this, and then we find this method M1 A in A.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that signature, and that is the signature that we are going to use. So we would call exactly that signature. And mm-hmm. Then what then happens is we know the signature we're going to call, and then we look for the latest implementation. So if you move down the tree, you look mm-hmm. for the latest implementation with exactly that signature. And it turns out that there's no M1 that accepts an A.
That is wonderful. That is exactly what's happening here. Just for the people at home, because I think they won't understand what you've said up there. The thing is, you have to check at first for the static types of all your parameters. You also have to include your receiver in the parameters. So you have to check for the static type of A and the static type of B. Where do you get the static types of these things? You have to look for the declarations. So for A, you get static type A, and for B you get the static type B. So that's the first thing: determine the static types. What do you do then? Well, now you know the signature of the call. Next, you have to look within the offered methods of the receiver. So the static type of the receiver is A. So we have to look inside A what method signatures are actually offered in there. So with the name M1, I only have two choices here. And as I have one parameter, I have to choose this one. I don't have anything. So that is the static type of your call. As this method spawns a kind of family that is connected with this dispatching mechanism, you might wonder whether there is a more recent implementation, a more special implementation of this one. So I have to look at what is actually arriving at this call site as a dynamic type. The dynamic type is the one that is determined for an object at creation time. So this object A comes from B, and the B comes from here. So a dynamic type of your receiver is actually B. So I might even look up whether I find a concrete implementation inside of B for this method signature, M1A, and turns out I have an implementation that is that belongs to the same name, but even though I have a valid specialization of my receiver parameter, the parameters that I find here are also more special than the ones that my generic function carries, and these are the ones that I am not allowed to specialize in my single dispatching, as Java supports that. So this is not a valid candidate for dispatching for this method call. So I cannot use this, and I have to resort to this implementation over here. So that is what happens here. Questions? Heavy discussions going on there?
No, it's okay.
It's okay? Yeah.
Just put up one little detail and two.
Okay. So, next one. I think that's even more simple here. Why is that? Well, there's actually no type casting going on here. So the only confusion that comes from this one is me using my letters a little bit in a weird way. So yeah. So actually, there's no casting going on. So there's not so much of a question what happens here, because for my object or for my call here, I'll have to still have to determine the static type. For the receiver, the static type here is now not cast, but it is just used from there. So it's B this time. For my parameter, it looks like it would be an A, but actually it didn't use any cast here, so it is still type B. And yeah, for this one, I think it's out of question. In this case, we will call this one. So that's not so exciting, but yeah, what about this one? M1B in B, or what is the exact string? So yeah, but what is the output? That is generated by that. M1 being P, so let's have a look. Ooh. Probably we should refine the happy people over there, so guess you guessed right. So is there any idea why that might be? Ah, yes. Yes, that, let me help you a little bit. To say we are now in class A means kind of you have a kind of implicit receiver type, and this implicit thing can be left away in Java, but implicitly you have this dot in front of that, and for that you'll be able to get the static type, and for this it is always the type that is in its frame, in its class frame. So that's A. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and when we think of this in front of it, then we have like the same like before with the A point.
Yeah. M1. Exactly. So it boils down to be exactly the same example as this one. I just kind of obfuscated a little bit the fact that there's a static type of A in the beginning. So that is something that's probably a little bit special in this Java thing, because you can remove this implicit this dot. So your receiver type is a little bit hidden, but in fact it boils down to be the same principle as we have had before. So once again, we have to look inside of class A for the generic signature M1 with the parameter B, and the only one that is applicable for this call is the one that is found above, and that is this one. So this one is the family of signatures that we are looking for, and although this looks in the first place looks like to be a call to M1 with B as a parameter, and in fact it is, it has as a static type of its parameter, it has B, but this class B with all its offered methods will never be considered for the search for your generic method, because the static type of the receiver, which is left away here but is in fact, this is A, so A is the maximal depth of your inheritance chain that you will look for an acceptable signature. Okay, so apart from that, that's the rest happens as it has in the very first example, so we come up with M1A in A. Nice. So, next one. M2. no, the side one. M2A in A. Okay, let's have a look. M2A in A. Oh, wow. So, yeah, why is that? So you have
the same case as before.
Mm-hmm. So you have this one. So now I have the signature M2 here, which is the same as this one.
Yes, but I called the method not a node as an object of class B. I called the method as an object of class A. And therefore I'm going to get a response of the object of class A.
In theory, yes, but yeah? Well, probably first you, then.
I think the thing that's going on that's interesting there is that this method M2 in A is static, so it's not dynamically dispatched. So once we call M2 this, we actually go to the static.
So that's why it ends up being like this. The thing that might lure people into believing that it's not M2A might be that the signature of M2 is for the fact of just covering the method name and the parameter type would be exactly the same in both ones, and so the parts that are matching are these ones, and we've said that we can specialize the first parameter, which is happening here. So that would be a case for virtual dispatching or dynamic dispatching, which is allowed in Java. But anyway, the problem is that this is, of course, something that deceives people, because you have to look at the other modifiers too. That is a practical issue. That's not so much to do with the dispatching itself. It just declares via keyword static that this call, a call to the signature, won't be treated with a dynamic dispatch anymore. So that's why the whole call ends up in outputting M2A in A. Okay. So last one, probably you have already guessed. I'm continuing my scheme with M3. Yeah, so this now introduces a little bit of confusion with the super keyword, as you will see. So that also messes around a little bit with your types and static typing, probably also dynamic typing, who knows. So ideas for this? Well, to get it over with. M1A and A, correct. And why is that? Well, in this case, you have your super keyword to specify the static receiver type. And yeah, this once again gives you, or in this case, doesn't give you the type B as your static type for the expression on the left-hand side of the dot, but instead will give you A as its type. So I have to look up M1 once again in A. So we end up with the same call that we have seen once again. So yeah, it's just messing around a little bit with static types. But yeah, this is a little bit tricky, as you've seen. And we will have a few possibilities to get to know this in the exercises. So let's have probably a little bit of an insight into how the whole thing really works. So why is it... yes? Yes, of course. Mm-hmm.
Why?
So let's remove this thing and change this one into public. Okay, what would you say? I think this is referring to the call to M2 that is probably referring to this one, I guess. Isn't it? Okay. Is it still the same if I change it to public? Yes, please. So the dynamic type of this is B, exactly. So what is the influence of this one when the dynamic type is B instead of A?
Yes, exactly. And B is basically an extension of A, which means we would like we would in this case call the method of B, which better fits.
Well, the important thing is that you first look. Although you look up the generic function in here, you have the situation that now that we have changed our keywords away from static and private and all that shit to public, we are now also considering this this B, which is a child of A, for searching a more specific version of my generic method. And turns out that we find one which has, apart from the receiver type, the exact same types. So that is a valid, concrete method that belongs to the generic method that we had above. So this one is actually associated with each other. These are associated with each other. And the later one will be a valid option for overriding. Yeah, we would have. Yeah, for searching the type of your generic method, it will find this one in A. But at runtime, well, it will generate. We will see that it will generate in your bytecode exactly a call with the signature that it found in class A. But the important thing is that when you remove these keywords and change them into public, it will generate the call not with a static call but with a dynamic call, and the runtime will then in its special invoke dynamic instruction will then look for the most specific implementation in starting from the dynamic type of this. And the dynamic type of this is still B, as you can see here. So it will start from B, its search, and we'll see, yes, there is actually a concrete implementation that matches this family that was spawned by the generic function. So this is a valid candidate for dispatching to. And this invoke dynamic will then actually just call the method body that is registered under this object B. So it will actually really do this one. Well, we will have a look into how these things work next, because, well, that's what I've prepared my slides for. So the whole system works in a kind of a collaborative way between your Java C, which is your static compiler. It can do all static stuff, especially looking up all these static types of the objects that you've used inside your program. So this one has to do something with this whole dispatching job. The other thing is that that I've already mentioned is that when these bytecode files are interpreted, there needs to be some kind of search going on for the most specific implementation with respect to the dynamic type of what ends up there. And that's done by the runtime, in this case the hotspot JIT interpreter or compiler or whatever. So let's have a little bit of delve into these software projects, and keep in mind what we're looking for. This is how calls like the one from equals are actually interpreted from the framework that we have with something like Java. So first, a few prerequisites. Function, well, the Java C compiler is something that is written itself in Java, so that should be, as long as you know Java, you should also be able to read what the Java C compiler does, and I would really recommend to do so. It is openly available, and it has a quite clean project structure, and you can actually quite easily find the relevant parts. It is constructed in a very standard way with phases for lexical analysis, syntactic analysis, and then syntax tree analysis for semantic properties, and then does code generation with kind of recursive calls or even visitors. I don't remember exactly, but it is a kind of standard concept that it uses inside. So you can really get the hang of what's going on inside that by just looking into that. And yeah, that's what I did for this thing. So we will have a look at how a method call is actually translated into bytecode. And for this, two helper functions are used. For once, there's the method is applicable, which is called on an array of static types of these are the types of the parameters that are found in the source program at a method call, for example, and on a member definition that is kind of a definition of a method, and it is checked whether when your parameters are like the ones in your args array, whether this method definition is actually valid for that, if you can apply a method like this to parameter types that you've given them in your args parameter. So, and how this thing works is, well, it checks a few security measurements, like whether you have whether you actually have a method in your member definition, whether it has the same number of types. And actually, the most important one is the one below. That is this one here. And this one checks whether each of the arguments that are actual parameters at your method call are more specific than the ones from the definition of the method that you're checking against. And in case that all of them are at least as specific as the ones from your method definition, you return true. Yeah. So this is more specific, called for two types, is based on, yeah, you can have a kind of relation of a specialization relation between types. You create this relation by inheriting between classes. The child is always more special than the parent, and there's also a few given specializations. Arrays are, for example, special objects, and what else? There's yeah, integers are special doubles, for example, something like that. So there's this relation, and this is checked with the is more specific called on types. There's also another version of an overloaded version of is more specific that is called later on in the code that we'll see, and this one is between two function definitions, and just for completeness, this one decides whether if you compare two methods, whether the signature of one is in fact more specialized than the signature of the other one by comparing their argument types. So that is how the whole thing is done. Okay, so that's just for completeness, because the most interesting one is the one that we use for when we actually want to translate a call to a method. How do we determine the generic method? And that's what you see here. And what you get to begin with, to start with, is the actual argument types at the method call and the method name. And a statically determined definition of the receiver, which is in this class definition of the accessor. Okay, so what's actually done is that we keep a kind of candidate for the generic method in a special variable, and we run through all the methods that have the name that we have from our call signature. And for each of them, what we do is we have a look at whether the method that we were given by the class definition is actually applicable for the argument types that we found. So these are the static types, and we check whether they are actually more at least as special as the ones that the method is the method was defined with. And in case that it is, then there's a little bit of access checking, so that's something that doesn't interest us too much in this respect. What happens then is just comparisons on whether our candidate for the most special generic method so far, which we have kept in tentative, is actually more special than the one that we've found so far. If the one that the one that we have found right now, if it is the case that the one that we found right now is more special than the one that we have had as a candidate so far, then we keep the newly found one as our new special one. There's also a little bit of a caveat, because specialization based on a whole array of types might yield situations where you have probably at the first parameter a more specialized type and a second one not. And later on, you find in your list of methods, you find an implementation where the first one is actually not more special than the one you have, but the second one. And both of them might be specializations. So to keep respect to this situation, you check for the contrary, for whether the other one is more specific than the one that you have before, and then you fill a kind of candidate list afterwards with that. So you still keep them. You have to do something like that in order when you iterate once again through the loop, you might find a more appropriate candidate which specializes all of the ones that we have kept as candidates so far. So that's what we're doing here. And in the end, we will come up with our candidate as at least in case where it is more special than all the candidates that we have found so far, and in case that it is not special enough to specialize all of the candidates that we found, we have found an ambiguous situation where we cannot really decide which of the ones that we have found are actually appropriate to use as a generic method. And in this case, you will see something that you probably have seen not so often in writing Java programs. There's an error, a compile time error, that is, I don't know the exact error message, but it comes from here. It means that the Java compiler has statically tried to find the most specific overloaded method signature, but it could not determine an unambiguous most special signature for your specific call. So it will bail out with an error message at this point. Okay. So I hope this algorithm is so far clear. This one is the search for the generic method. This one works all with static types, no dynamic types involved. This one kind of tells you which family of signatures are spawned for a call. Okay, but the result that you get from this method, that the Java compiler then generates code. And so the match method returns the most specific statically known signature for your call, and hard codes the signature as a parameter to the invoke virtual instruction in your bytecode. So that is what your bytecode for the example above looks like. It will sport the static type of the generic method. In Java bytecode, these are kept in a kind of pool, so you only find the index into the pool table for the whole thing, which is this 6 here, but the disassembler of Java bytecode provides you for convenience with the actual signature later on in the comment, so that is the actual type of the call. And the other thing is, you will find it being interpreted with the invoke virtual instruction. Okay, so in order to understand how this dispatching works now, it is essential to know what the semantics of an invoke virtual is. And we can find out about that by looking into the runtime interpreter, which is the hotspot VM in this case, that's written in C++. It's also freely available, so you can look into the sources there. And after a little bit of searching, I searched the hell out of this thing, and in the end it interprets occurrences of invoke virtual by calling this resolve method thing on the given stack contents, which contains the receiver and the parameter. So within this resolve method thing, there's a lot of things going on which are not really important for our case, so I will black them out. Well, at least I plan to. So these things are not so really interesting for us. Also, this one is not so important. So the main thing is redirect once again. But in principle, if you want to be interested in all the aspects that are involved when resolving methods, you have to look into these black boxes. I've printed them as a convenience for you, but actually this lookup works like this. It recursively traverses a superclass chain. How can you see that? Well, that is the iteration statement in the for loop, and this one goes to the super connection, so it goes down through this chain, always through this super member, and inside them it tries to find a method with a certain name and a signature. The only important thing to decide where it all starts is the the class description that is that the whole thing is initialized with, and this is something that is handed down from the very beginning. It seems that I haven't really printed it on the slides. Well, the actual thing is that this is queried from the object that is found on the stack, and as there's dynamically somewhere an object natural created somewhere, it is just handed down to calls on it as a pointer. So the pointer to the object will actually also always point to a representation for one of these natural objects. So if you query it for its class type, you will end up within the natural type. So this is the type that actually ends up here in this class and is searched for the right name and signature through its superclass chain. And the find method does no magic. It just does a plain binary search on the methods for the method name. So that is what's going on by default in the virtual machine, as long as it's not specialized in some degree by the hotspot. Okay, so there's two parts for this whole signal dispatching. There's at compile time, where the compiler is working, where it determines the static type of your generic call and puts it into a signature. It puts it in a special signature because it first searches for the most specific one that is statically known. This one is hard-coded in the bytecode and given to the runtime, and the runtime then does the whole dynamic resolving, and it does it by checking the actual dynamic type chain down to the object root. And the main thing is that it never changes the actual signature. The signature is statically fixed, the one that we have determined at the statical phase, which is the compiler phase. So yeah, that's how it works, like you have seen in our quiz examples. So that's all about how signal dispatching works in our conventional languages. So what can we do to solve the problem that we had initially we wanted to dispatch to our more special version of the whole thing. So there are a few things that you might do here, and I've written a few aspects of it here. It's introspection, generic programming, and some other mysterious stuff. So first solution, it's probably the most standard solution that I've seen so far. That's probably what every one of us has already done whenever he or she has implemented the equals method. It's, well, in a language like Java, where you have the opportunities to means to access tests for runtime types, you can use them to do your dispatching. So in languages where you have something like instance of or get type or get runtime type, which is the more important one, you can create code like this one and just bail out when the type is not okay, and otherwise do this stuff that you wanted it to do. This obviously works. We've done that so far a million times. But of course, that's something. Well, we hear when we value compilers and runtime systems and language design, we can of course have an ideal view on how we would like programming languages to work. And of course, that is something with this solution. We will burden the programmer with keeping attention to what types might be involved, what might end up in this equals at some times. And well, what we do is actually we give them the whole control about the whole control for their types, and they have to to make sure that everything works by themselves. We take away the comfort of a kind of type system that helps us in keeping types correct. With something like this, you can easily end up with a lot of if-then code, and that was that always smells a little bit like spaghetti code. So I'm not so sure whether this is the ideal solution, especially when we are designing languages. So we could ask for more. And of course, we have to keep in mind that that only works for languages that actually have access to runtime type information. If you think back to something like C++, well, runtime type information is not so easily done there. There has to be a certain extension to support that. So, yeah. The other idea would be to be a little bit more creative. And that's one of the approaches that I have offered you here. So the idea was, well, when it is a bad idea to fix the signature of a call quite up in my inheritance relation already, how would be the idea of not fixing it right now, but keep the type of the parameter that I want the generic method to be like, to keep it as a type parameter and fill it only at the place where I actually know what type I'm going to use. So that's the idea here. I've introduced an interface for exactly that purpose. It gets a type variable and uses it for its first parameter. That is one of the parameters that I'm not allowed to dynamically dispatch to. So, the idea is to circumvent the whole thing and specialize it when I need it. So, with that, I can then legally implement one of these methods equals with the special type, and I make this whole object as a child of, or well, to implement this special interface, so that I can create special set implementations that are aware of the fact that you can have this equalizable on special types. Whenever I do something like that, I would have to parameterize the place where I the methods where I do the comparisons for equality, where I put my type parameter t that I've got here, and when you do it like that, you will end up with your static signature at this point of the source code being parametric, and with the natural here, you will get it to be the natural. So in principle, this should work. But as it turns out, well, that was probably a quite creative approach to the whole thing, and probably quite nice, but of course, you need another set implementation as would be the default, but that shouldn't bother us too much, because when we design APIs, well, you probably have to do it in the right way. This might the Java way might not have been a good idea in the first place, but turns out the Java system suffers from a more devious problem here, because some decision in the past was to keep the implementation of type parameters in a way that the type parameters are there in their special way only at the source code level, while the translation schemes for translating these generic versions of code and these type parameters throw away all the information that you bother to provide it, and just keep a kind of naked version of your signatures, where all the occurrences of type parameters are replaced with object. This is called type erasure, and this leads to the problem that when you do it like this, you will end up with your method equals with the parameter a natural being being cut down to equals object once again, and with this one you will have exactly the same problem that you had before. When your runtime doesn't support something like type parameters, you also won't be able to specify what we've done quite bothersome with this construct. So, yeah, Java in this case, in the past, it has only offered a warning. In the more recent versions, it actually yields an error that that is introduced here. It tells you that the idea that you had was probably a good idea, but turns out that the type erasure kills your plans. So yeah, you cannot do this one because it would conflict with the equals that is already inherited via the object as your general parent. Okay, so the only way around that is to kind of cheat and change the environment, well, the language itself. And one way of doing that would be to think, well, probably it was not a good idea to restrict specialization only to the return parameter and the receiver, the return type and the receiver type, but to specialize even more. Even the other parameters types would be probably a good idea. So this led to the to an extension in Java later on, which is the thing that I consider kind of cheating in this thing. Yeah, how it works is that your specializers are kind of annotated to the implementations that you give the system, the runtime system then dispatches to the concretization with the parameters that belong to the call. And how can you do that? Well, at first you have to do type checking for the whole thing. This does not change too much. The only thing that you have to be aware with type checking is that now you have to check whether you can do as an increment to what you've done before is you can help the user by identifying that when you use a call like this, you will end up with an ambiguity between concrete implementations. So please change that. That's something that your type system is able to detect in many cases. Unluckily, you have to have a few restrictions on your methods in order to work that. And as soon as you introduce something like multiple inheritance for implementations of methods, for example, you run into problems that you cannot statically detect anymore. And for this, you would have to introduce also new runtime ambiguity exceptions that have not been there before. But apart from that, type checking can be extended with a few helpers that will tell you about situations where you run into ambiguity of concrete methods and generic methods. Okay, apart from that, what would you have to do for your code generation schemes? How would you have to extend them? Well, what you would do is you would generate your specialized methods. This is only one proposal for how to do that, but what you would be able to do quite easily is to translate your specialized methods ordinarily under a special name, and then make of the generic method just make that a concrete dispatcher doing all these tedious checking of runtime types and generate this thing automatically, and make this call your specialized versions that you have generated before. And Yeah, by the right order and sequence of checks, you can make sure that you will get the most special version of your method. Of course, the more parameter you will have, the more complicated this will get, and this will have, well, if you have a lot of parameters and a lot of specializations, you will have a quite severe performance penalty there. But it, the main thing that you should keep in mind is that this only happens whenever you actually use your specialization of the parameters. And if you don't use it, it won't affect your performance at all. Okay, so there has been an implementation of that, which is called MultiJava, which you can find in the literature. And it actually works as promised. What you can do here is that you can specify for the generic method signature that you have here with the name and the type of the first parameter, you can specify specializers. These are specifying the dynamic type that this parameter should have. And when I do it like this, the system will create the dispatcher for this equals object signature and will fork based on this parameter n, whether it has a dynamic type of natural or object, and will then either call a method that is generated from this body or the default method. So when you implement the whole system like this and you add your naturals, you will only end up with one natural. So you have good clean code and the behavior that you wanted. So yeah, what does it do on the implementation side? That is the disassembled version of your bytecode, and you'll see that what is happening is actually that the equals object will be the new dispatcher function that will at first do an instance of test whether the whole thing has as first parameter natural. Whenever it has that, it will cast the parameter into natural with this one and then call a specialized version. You see there's a scrambled special name for that, and this one will contain the version for the first parameter being natural. And in any other case, it will jump to 16, where the system will call just the standard object implementation of equals. So that's what the system is generating for you. It does a simple redirect based on the dynamic type of the whole thing. So, but this might look a little bit awkward to you. The question is how would this look like in a language that was aware of multiple dispatching being a core principle? And Java clearly was designed with the concept of single dispatching in mind, with all this receiver being treated specially and all that. So, these are this situations that will happen a little bit more often in future in programming languages. We'll have a look in special languages. You're not supposed to learn these languages by heart. I just show them to you as a kind of inspiration, what other languages make of the concepts that we introduce here, and to broaden your vision a little bit. So, Clojure is a kind of Lisp dialect, and Lisp is one of the languages that's famous for the fact that you can create your language features yourself within the language. So, no wonder that, or little wonder that there is the a feature for multiple dispatching possible in Lisp, because well, it was extended in that way. So, yeah, in order to understand the examples that I'm going to show you a little bit, there's a few of the basic concepts of Clojure that is, well, as it is Lisp, it is a language that is for Lisp processing, and so lists are basic basic comp, a basic block for the whole thing. And there's constructors for lists, and these are just common brackets. With these, you can create new lists. In Lisp, you can also create user-defined keywords for use for field names or just as simple singletons. So that's what keywords in Lisp are for. And you have the special brackets for creating vectors. You can create lambda expressions that with the keyword fn and the parameters being mentioned as a vector. And then as the last element here, you have the body of that function. And you also see that for this closure definition, Lisp reused a lot of concepts. For example, especially the list constructor that is used for or at this position. So it means that for Lisp, a closure is just a list with several components. It has at first an introductory keyword, and then the next element in this list is the parameters. And the next element in this list is just the body of the whole thing. So, the body, once again, is also a list. And, so forth. So lists are really the core component of Lisp. Good. So next thing is what I've used for creating hierarchical relationships, because, the things like objects that are so common in Java or C++ are not so common in Lisp. You would do, probably you would use functional programming there, but in order to simulate something like objects or classes, you can use this derive clause with keywords. I've used keywords in multiple ways, and also to represent objects at some place, but you will see later on. And then the core thing that is important for us right now is, because we are interested in multiple dispatching, is how to generate a generic method, which is called a multi-method in Clojure, and how to create a concrete method, which is this def method thing. A little side note, probably, this is one of the things that we will run into a lot of times in the next lectures. There's no such thing as uniquely named language features. In one language, you might find something like traits being mix-ins, and others you might be the other way around. Here you have something like generic methods, which are the same thing as multi-methods. In Java, you have generic methods being methods used with type parameters. So there's a lot of confusion going on there. And you must always be aware that there might be overloaded meanings of the techniques that we have here. And you have to judge by the features that these things offer and not by the names. And that's one of the common mistakes when you discuss with colleagues or friends about your favorite programming language. And you say, I'm especially fond of the generic methods here. And you say, Java has that long ago. And that's the problem with this kind of naming clashes. And same thing happening here. The things that we have got to know as multiple dispatching, multiple dispatching that fits with multi-methods, but in the literature you have found something like that already as generic methods. And so there's a lot of confusion going on, but you can introduce or spawn a new family of methods that are connected to each other with multiple dispatching by introducing a new multi-method when you program Clojure. And you do that once again as a list and with a special word defmulti. And what you do there is the rest of the list needs to be an identifier or a name. And Yeah, the next thing is something special, which is called dispatch function here. And this is connected with concrete methods that are introduced with this def method thing with the same name and a certain dispatch value. What this thing is, we will see afterwards. And we also have to specify there's also a Lisp specialized thing. This is some kind that matches with the complete rest of what is given to an instance of this def method thing. And it is supposed to be supposed to be the tail of a lambda expression, meaning the parameter list and the body list, the parameter element of such a list and the body list. And we will use to create a new closure internally, but yeah, that's probably way too deep into closure. We don't need it to be so deep for understanding how closure does with or manages with multi-methods. So let's start with a very, very basic example. First of all, I establish an artificial inheritance relation between two things, things being keywords that I misuse to be something like objects. So I've introduced a new keyword that is called parent and a keyword that is child, and child is a special parent. That's something that I defined with this element. Next, I introduce a new family of multiply dispatched methods with a def multi. The name for this method will be fun, of course. They're very fun, these methods. And what I need to provide next is the actual dispatching method. I'll tell you in a minute what this one does. Let me first introduce the concrete methods. These are defined with the same name as the multi method. And here in a list element that is supposed to be the result of what the dispatching function gives. So this function over here will return something, and you find this here for the concrete method. And here you find the actual implementation of this concrete method, meaning you have the parameters A and B, and I just throw them away, and the output of the whole thing is the string child equals. Okay. I introduce another one of these, this time with a different return value for this dispatcher function, and then our definitions are over. And now I can test my method. So I do that by calling fun, and I give them two objects. In this case, I have my objects being children or child objects. Okay, so what happens now is that the Lisp system will call the dispatching function on the parents. The Lisp system will call the dispatching function on the parameters, which are both child objects. The dispatching function just receives them and just hands them back. And now the Lisp system compares what it has gotten back from the dispatcher function with the things that that we have defined at this component for the concrete implementations. So in case that I have given the whole system child, the system compares this and says, okay, this matches, so I will call this concrete implementation. So this looks awfully complicated, but it's just because the application that we've given it is quite simple, one that might probably also have had no use for this kind of multiple dispatching. It is more complicated when I try to tackle the problem that we had before with the natural numbers. So now I have tried to generate a more appropriate representation of the problem with means of Lisp. And as still there's no real similar means for representing objects in Lisp than we have in Java. I have used kind of maps now for my objects. And I can now generate natural maps and object maps, and I store their identity, being once natural and being once object, in the class under the class key in my mappings. And whenever I create one of these natural objects, I also take a parameter, and this is a parameter that I store under the number key. Okay, so equipped with this one, I also introduce equality methods as a multi-method. No, not like this. So I introduce multiply dispatched equality methods. And this time, I have my specializer do a little bit more. My specializers take the two parameters of my multi-method, and this time they actually do something. They query the maps that they are given for the class key. They do that also for the second one, and the result value that I get from that will be then compared with the values that are found in the respective places in their concrete methods. And whenever I do my equality checks on actual naturals now, the whole system will query my objects N1 and N2 for the class key. Whenever I have created my methods as my maps as natural via the natural methods, I will have stored natural as value under the key class. So natural will be returned for this query, and will be matched with this this part of the concrete method. And whenever my equal encounters two natural objects, they will both of these calls will return natural, and we will be able to construct such a vector with natural and natural here, and the equals on natural maps will happen. And in this case, I implemented it as it would be natural by the equality on the number part of the first parameter and the number part of the second parameter. So this one does exactly the same as the solution that we've seen on the a little bit further on with the multiple dispatching in Java. And you might wonder what happens when I compare an object with a number. And then in this case, the object won't give me natural, but object as a value for the class key. So this will make sure that the result of the dispatcher function will never match with this value, which is natural, but with something else. And for multiple methods, I can also offer a concrete method that is used by default when no other values match. In this case, I will always yield false. It's probably not the really correct version, but that's what happens here. Okay. I hope you're not too confused right now, because it's to be there's still another level what we can reach. We can be even more creative with the whole thing and give the whole system a really creative way of how to do dispatching. And in fact, we don't have to dispatch at all on actual types, but with something like this, we can dispatch on pretty funky things also, like the values of certain attributes of fields or something. And yeah, that's done here. This is when you have understood what the whole thing does, I think you'll get the joke. But I think as time is already passing quite quickly, I will skip that and leave you this joke for at home, and go on with the conclusion for the whole thing. So what we've seen here is this principle of multi-dispatching. There's a few aspects of the whole thing. For once, you might reason for multiple dispatching, because it's kind of a generalization of a technique that you already know from something like polymorphic method dispatching already, and it is kind of a thing that you intuitively expected probably already before, and solves a lot of problems that are actually occurring in practice, and it's also something that eliminates a lot of boilerplate code, which might be potentially also dangerous whenever you miss one of the checks that you would have been nice to have, and it's something that is also compatible with systems that we have nowadays. You've seen this multiple dispatching. Java is just a little extension to general Java, and the code that comes from there is actually executable on just plain simple Java virtual machines, so this is quite nice in respect. But there's also a kind of major reasons why you would not like to have multiple dispatching. For example, from a kind of design point of view, you would as we've seen, the languages have quite explicitly stressed that they treat the first parameter more special, and for languages that are designed like that, it's probably counterintuitive to offer some feature like multiple dispatching. There's also runtime overhead that is heavy with this, although you might debate whether this is really playing such a major role, because you would have to implement boilerplate code that also use up runtime, so whatever. There's new exceptions that come into play whenever you try to introduce that in multiple inheritance-enabled systems, where you can also multiply inherit implementations. For details, I refer to the paper and the exercise. We plan to show you a few of these situations. And also, there's this most specific method ambiguity will happen a lot more with multiple dispatching, as it has happened with the method dispatching that you've seen as state of the art. Well, I guess, has there been anybody in the audience that has occurred with such an ambiguous compiler error so far? With none. Okay, so the probability increases a lot when you introduce this multiple dispatching. Apart from that, there's also other languages that are probably not so mainstream that offers features for multiple dispatching. There's Dylan, which you might probably not know, but it has quite a nice notion of syntax for using this multiple dispatching feature. And also there's Scala, which also has the possibility of doing multiple dispatching, but being a functional language that does with structural matching all the time is probably not so prominent there and doesn't probably play such a large role as it does in standard C-oriented languages. Okay, what should you take away from the whole thing? Well, dynamically dispatching is something that is not done so easily. You have to think a lot, and you have to know a lot about how compilers and runtime systems work together. You should have seen an open source compiler probably for the first time. If not, congratulations. That's really nice. And also, there's you've seen how you can generalize a concept like dynamic dispatching to be a lot more as it is currently with single dispatch languages. You've seen multiple dispatching working in Java, in Clojure, and you've also seen or at least got the references to other languages that also support that. So that's what I want you to have learned. So far, there's also these papers where I have taken all the knowledge from. I'd be interested in having a deeper look in those also. But apart from that, I thank you for your audience and hope you had a good time here. Thank you.